seated right now. That's right, the next installment of our famous Sports Greatest Photo Show. Just when you thought you may have seen it all already, Part 3 dishes up 10 more photos and 10 more sensational stories. From back when England were world champions of football, through to the day our planet almost shifted off its axis because of a slip catch. It's an action-packed hour of sports like you have never seen before. It's episode 58 of The On The Bounce Show. Let's get into it. Welcome to it, episode 58, and we bring back Sports Greatest Photos. Oh, I'm excited about this. It's part three of this. If you haven't seen the previous two, I really recommend that you do, because not only will you be entertained by the visuals, you'll also be schooled by what's happened in sport with some of the biggest moments. I tell you what, right now, just having the two guys to my left is a pretty big moment because I have not seen them for a while. We have Sandile back, and we have Cooks. He is back.
Good to be back.
Yeah, it's great to be back. I got to give a big shout-out to Cooks, a.k.a. High Rock's Finest. We saw him sweating it out there. I needed to borrow him a pair of legs so he gets back to Johannesburg. How was that for you, bud?
It was good. I think I did end up shirtless. I mean, I feel like it's a High Rocks thing to do. Like,
do you not get deducted points if you're not shirtless?
I got a 5-minute penalty because I was probably like wearing a shirt most of the time.
Come on.
Well, the funny thing is, when you stand in the tunnel about to race, like, there's like, I think there's like my batch, there's about, say, 20 of us. I think 18 of them also are shirtless. So, me and my mate, like, standing there looking at each other, like, as if, like, that fat kid in the beach, like, wow, why do I have my shirt on?
Now, but a lot of guys do High Rocks just so they can be shirtless.
Yeah. But just like, let me just start the exercise first, and then I'll sort of figure it out from there.
Yeah.
And then the FOMO comes. But yeah, it was good fun. Enjoyed it. There are easier ways to get a beer, but on the Saturday, but it was good fun.
But well done. I mean, talk about near death. I know if you've been watching the previous sports photo shows, you know this is Dimitri Leontakianakis's realm. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Dimitri's actually in hospital right now. Flex, I've got a picture of him that I snuck in this morning and took just for the show there.
Damn.
That's Dimitri right now. He's not looking his best, but he does send his wishes.
It's the fan for
me. Yeah, I put the fan in there. So Dimitri's under the weather at the moment, so he can't be with us. Yeah. He will be with us again, though. I mean, I'm not trying to make it. absolute near death. And Sandile, after your time in Ibiza, you must feel like life has almost come to an end as well.
Oh, man, it was life-changing. But I'm so glad to be back home. But also, guys, we got to make the Rand great again. That's the one thing. After traveling, we have to make the Rand great again. It was 1 to 20 is unreal. It's actually unreal.
You know what? We should never be this poor. And I know we can talk about domestic politics, but we want to be people of the world as well, right?
100%. Yeah.
And you cannot be when they're asking you for like 300 Rand for a beer.
Yeah. No, it's impossible.
100%. And we've got a World Cup to go to in the US, so, you know, we got to sort that stuff out.
Make it happen. All right, guys, look, I could talk about our private lives at length. As you may have noticed, I have no hat on this week.
Pushing the Jason Statham.
This is my journey back to full head of hair. You'll see the top of my head today for the first time in about a month. Interesting enough, Cooks has actually got the most hair in the entire studio this week.
This is the craziest thing ever. Yeah, man,
I'm proud of it. Like, the only thing missing would be like, just, you know, give it a bit of a wave.
All right, guys, so we need to get into it. Yes, basically, we've got another 10 photos. Yeah. I wasn't sure how much we could actually stretch this podcast series, but we're on to episode 3, and there is so much to get through here. Some stories that I had no idea about and some stories I've always wanted to share. So we're going to be back after the break with 10 of the next best sporting photos of all time and the stories of them. All right, welcome back. We have 10 amazing sports photos for you and the stories thereof. And we are going to start off with 1966. This was the time all English people thought was the greatest time in sport. It was the FIFA World Cup final back when England won it.
Yeah, it's crazy that this is it for English football.
1966, the country that invented football, the hallowed home of Wembley, and this was the last time that they saw that, 1966.
Yeah, that's a shout out to Bobby Charlton there. You know, there were some legends who played on that team, but it's crazy for me that this is all that England, the home of football, have.
Like, not even like a Euros. You know what I mean? Like
nothing.
Not even a Euros, yeah.
Like, it's just that. And the funniest thing is, like, every year, I mean, every World Cup and every Euros, football's coming home.
Yeah.
It's coming home. Eventually, like, if it hasn't come home since 1966, I think maybe football's got a new home. I'm like,
global. Very well put, Cooks. I mean, I think I could throw away everything else I've got to say about this game. I think you just nailed it in a lot.
I just love. I'm like, I mean, at one point you go like, okay, it's
like we just football.
Yeah, we just football. Like, you've won a World Cup, and you're like, it's okay to invent something. And it's like, eventually, like, you can't be like, no, it's gotta come home. It's gotta come home. It's, my favorite is like with England. Is like, it's after the first like group game win. So even like in the semis, they're just like, okay, guys, we're back.
Yeah, they get like a 3-1 win over Iran or someone. Yeah. It's like none of the teams come together here.
Yeah, but exactly.
It was actually quite a beautiful final in many respects because, firstly, it was only the second time in the entire tournament where the anthem was sung. Now, the reason being is that they had the anthem in the opening game and the final game because they didn't want to play the North Korea anthem. So what they decided to do was they decided to scrap the anthems for the entire tournament.
Everyone just played Disky.
Just so they could not have the North Korea anthem.
So everyone suffered. So
like, everyone suffered. But it was a wild time because, as we may know now, England won that 4-2, right? Yeah. It was 2 goals in injury time from Jeff Hurst, scored a hat-trick on the day. But do you guys know what would have happened if it did end in a stalemate, end in a draw?
Coin flip.
No shootout.
No shootout. They would have played a replay on the Tuesday.
No.
Seriously. I mean, like, back in 66, like, common sense had to prevail. The entire world wants to watch a World Cup final.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, guys, look, we don't get a result here. We're going to just come back on Tuesday.
I love the facts because, like, I'm sure it's on a Saturday. Like, imagine if we go, like, okay, so you get 2 days. You get 2 days to rest.
Tuesday.
We go again on Tuesday.
No.
Like.
So, thankfully, that didn't happen. Jeff Hurst ended up scoring his hat-trick in injury time, and they won it. And they beat West Germany at the time. So as we know in modern times, England's biggest bogey team is Germany, right?
Yeah.
But back then, they won 6 out of 7 matches against them leading up into that game.
Can I ask a question? I know I
might including the war as well.
Well, there's also that. So, I mean, they had a good run against the Germans.
Shout out. Because we always hear about this is Bobby Charlton's World Cup. What's his name? Jeff Hurst? Jeff Hurst?
Yep.
Did he become a sir? Did he get knighted afterwards?
Well, Paul Collingwood became a sir after taking 2 slip catches in an Ashes series.
I knew they were going to get dragged. I knew it.
I'm pretty sure Jeff Hurst would have got
100%. Out Jeff Hurst, yeah.
Some sharp object would have touched his shoulders at Buckingham Palace at some stage in this conversation.
Yeah, 100%.
We never get to hear the story about Jeff Hurst. Shout out on a hat-trick on that. That's big for you.
Yeah, look, there were some absolute legends. Yeah. Another thing that was interesting about this match is that we know that football nowadays, to go to any big event, going back to what you said in the intro about things being expensive in Europe, in today's money, it would have cost you all of £10 to go watch that final on that day.
Still like 100.
Price of a beer now.
That's like 150,000 rand. So.
So basically, for the price of a beer back in 66, you could have watched the FIFA World Cup final and you would have had this amazing moment. 100%. 10 shillings in that money.
Oh, shout out.
If you go through this team, there were so many legends. A couple of strange quirks came out that all of them sold their medals, their winning medals.
That is sad.
So they're in eBay, they're in markets, they're in private auctioneer houses, they're all around.
I find it funny, like, with guys who do buy that, because, like, imagine I go to someone's house and be like, oh, by the way, I got Sir Bobby Charlton's World Cup medal. I'd be like, so why does he have it? Like,
yeah, like, it's almost like stolen valor.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you paid for it,
sporting memorabilia, but something as personal as a medal, like, that's, it's not like they came across hard times, it's just that back then it didn't mean that much. So they're like, yeah, I'll flog this. Probably flogged it for another 10 shillings because...
yeah. So
and then the World Cup was like this big. Sorry, you guys can't see it.
Yeah,
like,
I remember our trophy show.
Yeah,
it was very small and it was the Jules Gillette.
It was before
the main one, yeah.
And it was solid gold and it was stolen a couple of times.
But I love this. I love the shirt though. The shirt, if this was to come back,
still very nice.
It'd be fire.
Yeah, playing in red. Obviously, West Germany would have played in white. And then the goalkeeper on the day, Gordon Banks, his wife was West German.
Mm.
So, to her credit, though, she said, "Nope, I'm supporting England.
Support my mans."
And how did the FA repay her? No wags allowed to the winners' banquet.
What?
Talk about different times, huh?
That is.
It was probably completely agreed upon by all the players. Yeah. Like, no wags.
No
way. We're on a bender now for like the next week, and there'll be no women around us.
I mean, I think that is very well played. That's where Robert is.
Pre Coldplay era, so I'm feeling it.
Exactly.
Well, I had to throw that in.
So that was 1966. Of course, every major trophy comes up. England think they're going to win it. But, I mean, it's worth looking back at that time. It was pretty special. I think it's so funny that is their major only trophy, because we always look back to that photo because that's as good as it got. I want them to get to 2066. I want a centenary of no wins, and then let the floodgates open. They can win everything from there. I want to be a 100-year anniversary of this photo.
Well, I love the fact, like, since then, like, all the other big sporting sides have, like, broken their drought. Like, England's won cricket, they've got two World Cups now. And like
rugby's
got a World Cup, even the England women's got a Euro, yep. Euro, and then the final now. I mean, every other national side since then, England has done something except for these Turks,
which are technically their biggest national side. Football's the biggest sport. Yeah. That's the biggest, the longest serving team. Yeah, so that's it. Photo number two, we are going to go to a similar kind of era, 1950, and it was the U.S. Open golf tournament. This is probably the most famous. I mean, I know that this Tiger's fist bumps. Fist pumps will run anything close. Yeah. But this is probably the most iconic golf photo taken of all time. So that there is Ben Hogan, who Mr. Gary Player said was actually the greatest golfer of all time. He went on to win 9 majors, and this is him at Merion. So back in the day when men were men and clubs were unforgiving, he's hitting a 1-iron there. Now, Lee Trevino always made the joke that in a lightning storm, he'll hold a 1-iron into the sky because even God can't hit a 1-iron.
Yeah.
Basically, it's like taking a butter knife and putting some grooves on it. And there's Ben Hogan striping
right
one.
Through it.
Oh.
So 16 months prior, he was in a horrific head-on collision. Broke his collarbone. He broke his pelvis. He broke, there's actually a long list here, ankle, broke ribs. And the only way he survived the crash is that in the moment before impact with the bus, who was in his lane, he dived in front of his wife to try to save her. And in doing so, saved his own life. But 16 months prior to that photo, obviously doctors back in those days, I mean, I think if you had like a chesty cough, they said, like, you're never going to play again.
They said, that's it, yeah.
But everyone believed the doctor this time around because the oak was a mangled mess.
Yeah.
Prior to that, he had won 4 majors. He was by far the best golfer in the world. He was on an absolute tear. 16 months. He somehow managed to get back. And that was the first event he played.
And then he rocked like that.
What made it even worse is that back in the day, they played 36 holes in the final day.
Oh.
So this Oaks just got back to fucking walking and swinging a club. By the 13th hole of that round, he was in so much pain, he was about to quit. He was about to quit. It was so bad that his playing partner on the day was actually marking his ball on the green. So when it went down to putt, he would mark the ball for him. The Oak was fucked, but he just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. He stayed in contention. And to go back to that photo there, it was down to the point where he was in the middle of the fairway. He found that shot. He needed to make a par. So he needed to, from there to get into a playoff. So 36 holes in one day.
Injury, he's starting into a playoff to win this thing.
So now hits the 1-iron on the green, makes 2 putts, gets into the playoff. So the next day he's going to come back with his aching body.
Oh.
And back in those days.
Oh, US Open, you play the full round again.
And he won it. So he won the 1950 US Open on the back of that.
Surely that was it afterwards. He must have had a golf after that.
He did, but he went on to win 5 more majors.
What?
The story of Ben Hogan itself is another podcast waiting to happen. The Soak was so fascinating because he just walked away from the game after a while.
So thanks for.
He's like, yeah, I think that's good. I've had enough now. There's other things that I want to do and other people I want to be around. And he basically just went even more Scotty Scheffler than Scotty Scheffler and said that this is it for me. I no longer want to be a golfer.
Wow.
Different story.
I mean, that is incredible. I mean, like 5 majors post-op. I mean, also to come back at the US Open, which is one of the hardest majors. I mean,
really?
I mean it's brutal.
Absolutely brutal.
I mean, that is. And then you have to walk 36 holes and come back.
He said, like, playoff time, let's go.
I mean, it's a fun that while, because I think the last one was Tiger and Rocco. They were the last.
And they came back for full 18.
Came back for full 18.
Tiger on one leg. He also didn't need that as all in his life.
Yeah.
I just think, like, it's so wild. Like, you know, but we all love our golf. Like, if you play like 4 days of golf and they go, it's a tie. Listen, go play a whole round again tomorrow.
It's like the 1966 FIFA World Cup all over again. Come, guys, let's call it on the last day.
Just call it. It's like,
you're fucking up everyone's like travel plans. Yeah. The guys who are breaking down the stadiums now have to take another day off.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, you're not going to come and just play the 18th again. No. Go sleep, rest, and
jump. Yeah, but the US Open always took it too far. So there's a couple of other like sort of sub stories that come off the back of that photo. Obviously, that 1-iron, you would think, is a coveted item, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about the guys in 66 selling their medals.
Yeah.
That club, the 1-iron, was stolen shortly after in 1950. It then miraculously re-emerged in 1983. There was a golf dealer at the Players' Championship who got in touch with some unknown person who said that they had some really nice old clubs. So the guy's like, cool. He saw a couple of photos and he agreed on buying 8 clubs from this guy. When he got the bag, this dealer, he went through the bag and there was 9 clubs. And the 9th club was Ben Hogan's 1-iron. So the guy knew his stuff. He's like, this checks out. This looks exactly like Ben Hogan's 1-iron. Yeah. And then they actually gave it to Ben and said, is this your club? And he knew the markings. I mean, that oak practiced like 7 hours a day.
Yeah.
He knew the clubs like the back of his hand.
This is mine.
He said, nice to see an old friend again.
Oh.
So the guy who was just hustling golf clubs ended up selling the most famous club in golf. And that's where it came from. But the actual real hero outside of Ben Hogan in this photo is the photographer.
That's a crazy photo. We always try
and mention these guys. This dude, he came back from the Second World War. He had nothing to really do anymore because obviously the world was in turmoil. Yeah. And he put everything he had to buy film and a camera because he wanted to learn how to become a photographer. He then went on to become one of the most coveted photographers in the world across many, many things. His name was Hi Peskin. And Hi Peskin's belief was that he needed to get to understand his subject matter before he could ever photograph them.
Yeah.
So that oak followed him around the entire day. The only photo he took on that day
was that photo. Killer, shout out.
Because in his mind, he realized this is the most pivotal moment. And every other press photographer that day was in front of Hogan because they wanted to get a photo of Hogan's face.
Yes,
Hyatt Peskin was like, this is it. He wanted to frame the crowd, the top of the swing, the American flag, and he created golf's greatest photo.
That is an incredible shot.
Shout out to the shooters.
Shout out to that dude, man. Hi Peskin. He created that. Beautiful, beautiful story.
Jeez, okay. That is incredible.
So there's a bit of a theme today about selling sports memorabilia. So our next photo, our next amazing photo is the 1986 FIFA World Cup, which is best known for...
The hand of God.
There we go. Oh, there he is.
That's my guy right there. You can't play with that man, right?
To be fair, the way VAR goes this day, they'll probably still give the goal.
But I mean, it was... Guys, there is so much about this photo. Firstly, another World Cup England didn't win, obviously.
Yeah.
You know what? I feel bad for England on this one. The hand of God, I mean, come on, guys. Linesman.
So I'm glad that you said linesman there because after this goes in, and it's pretty blatant, Shilton goes up. It's not like they're together and there was like maybe a hand. The hand is the highest thing touching the ball. There is daylight between Peter Shilton and Maradona there.
And it's not like Maradona was the tallest brew in the world. That is my craziest thing.
So the referee on the day, Ali bin Nasser, he said he was unsighted because of where he was standing on the pitch. And FIFA, at the lead up to that tournament, said that they need to put greater power within the linesmen. So they need to really empower them to make calls on the spot. So straight away, on the back of that briefing, the ref, Ali bin Nasser, was like, straight away, look at his linesmen. And the Bulgarian, Bogdan Dochev, his words were, I sense something irregular.
But a goal's a goal.
But we couldn't discuss it with the referee, so he just said, yeah, cool.
Changed history.
So the English players could not believe it. But what made it even worse is that a few minutes later, Maradona scored a legit goal, which goes down.
He dribbled the whole defense.
As like the greatest goal of all time. Yeah. So England lost that one 2-1. They get booted out of the tournament again. 86, Argentina go on to win it. And Maradona, with the famous quote about the goal, he said the goal was scored a little with the head of Maradona, and a little with the hand of God.
Yeah, this is one of the most iconic football pictures and sports pictures of all time. I'm like, I knew it. When you said 87, I said, this is it.
So I tell you what's also really interesting about this photo in the context. This week, Peter Shilton's jersey you see there, it's going on auction.
Wow.
That's that same jersey.
That exact jersey that Peter Shilton is wearing there is going on auction this week, and it's been estimated around £300,000 what it's going to fetch.
Far more than 10 shillings.
That's a bit more than 10 shillings. Well spotted there, Cooks.
I mean, like, why? I just want to know why he's so high. Was he that great?
I mean, well, he's got 100 caps for England. I think one of the first ones.
Well, guys, he's...
I mean, like, it's just... Shout out Diego, R.I.P. a god right there, man.
But he's a player in the hand of God, right?
Yeah.
He's the goalkeeper whose fist wasn't high enough to get to the ball.
Yeah.
So that jersey's going to go on auction this week. £300,000 is what they're hoping to get, which is nothing compared to what Maradona's jersey got there in 2022. That jersey you see Maradona wearing in the Hand of God moment went for £7.1 million on auction.
I agree. Even a steal, you got it at a steal.
So, $7.1 million is what that thing went for. It's the most expensive sports memorabilia at the time. And there's various ways that they obviously verify this, right? And one of the greatest clips that I saw was what they said, it was a very hot day back then, so the shirt is a bit woofy.
It's a bit woofy.
All the Maradona sweat is stuck in there.
So, yeah, for £7 million.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you think about it, I mean, like, if it's probably the most iconic shirt you can bring, Brian, one maybe won the final. But because if you think about it, if you think of the 1986 World Cup, like, no one ever talks about doing his performance in the semi or the final, then winning it. Yeah. You go straight to the quarterfinal against England in the Hand of God. So, I mean, getting that shirt, I mean, there can't be many more iconic football shirts.
There really isn't.
From one of the greatest ever players.
So, that's the thing. One of the greatest ever players who is now dead. I don't mean to sound sadistic, but that raises the price.
Yeah.
One of the most iconic matches, as you say, and it's a World Cup winner.
Yeah.
And so, someone's got it. And I'm not entirely sure who's got it. But another sort of slight story around that, which I find quite interesting, is also in 2022, there was another piece of memorabilia auctioned from that match. It was the ball. So back then, it wasn't like numerous balls around the field. They played with just one ball.
Oh, no.
It was like a social match.
It's like,
okay?
It's like a derby day, like a high school derby day, when the game is shut down because the ball's down there.
So if that ball goes in the crowd, play only starts when it comes back into the field.
Crazy.
And so it went and it got auctioned, ended up being auctioned for £2 million.
I get that.
Okay, but this is the real cool part of the story. Do you know who gets that money? Who the owner of the ball was?
Who?
Diego.
The referee of that match.
No.
He took it because he grabbed the ball.
So in that tournament, every referee was probably being paid 10 shillings and a pint of beer. They all got the match ball that they refereed. So the guy who was responsible for not giving the Hand of God ball ended up scoring £2 million 40
giving
years later.
Corruption, this one. This one's giving some corruption.
Like, what an intense story.
Imagine like in 2022, you get called for match fixing for something you did in 86. You get called in.
It's prescribed.
How did I get there?
So the Tunisian referee, Ali Bin Nasser, he held onto this ball forever, a slight damage to it, but he got just over £2 million, which was a little bit under what they were expecting to get. And when asked what he'll do with the money, he said he's going to give some to charity and he's going to use the rest to uplift his standard of living.
I like it. He hit a bit of a pants on fire in the beginning, then he said, I got to change my life.
It's just so funny because like it was such a blatant handball. Everyone goes, the ref fucked that up. But the ref's actually probably the biggest winner here.
Yeah,
Maradona didn't get the $7 million from...
Guys, I'm saying the linesman. I mean, we're empowering the linesman. Linesman, well, make the call.
My favorite part is he says, I send something irregular,
he said,
but I can't talk to you, so, I mean, sweet.
That was it. Hey, Bogdan Dochev, he didn't get no £2 million. He went off into the shadows.
I hope he broke it off. I hope they broke him off something.
You got nothing, huh? All right, photo number four for this episode is probably one of the saddest, but we have to cover this at some stage. It is
Senna, gotta be.
The Ayrton Senna crash.
Oof.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't obviously amazing photos around this, but this is just one of the most harrowing images because, as you can see, that car is obliterated. As you can see, there's no protective barriers on that wall.
Jeez.
And in the far distance there, you'll see the emergency guy with his hands in the air.
Sure.
And the other guy is clamoring to get into that vehicle to get to the scene. They're all rushing for their equipment. It was a really, really tough moment, this. It was 1994.
Yeah.
So, obviously, everyone knows Ayrton Senna.
Yeah.
He was a three-time world champ. Yeah. He was with McLaren, the Marlboro car. He was very famous. He was Brazilian. He was very charismatic. Everyone loved the Oak. But as great as Senna was back then...
This accident,
So back then, the fastest car was the Williams car. So everybody wanted to be in that car. And the reason Williams was so damn good is that they had the greatest innovations, right? They had active suspension. It was the first time a car ever had active suspension, which allowed it to corner better. It was more responsive, and it was just huge. So... as they were the only ones doing it back in the early 90s, the FIA was then kind of forced into making a call. So what they said was, okay, guys, you're going to need to go back to passive suspension. And if you think about it, as we all know from Formula One cars, is that they are so interwoven. One innovation helps another thing, which then has a domino effect around all the little things. So by taking away the core of that, the active suspension, the car was suddenly a bit fucking shaky. So Senna got into this car, and prior to the 1994 season, where the car was going back to passive suspension for the first time, Williams were clamoring to try and get the car ready. Yeah. So pre-season driver testing, he didn't even have the car for that year. He had a modified version of the 1993 car. Williams ran out of time to perfect this car.
He said, let's go, try this.
Let's race this one.
Get in this car. Senna got into it. He said it was unstable. It was very fast, but it was unstable. First two races of the season, he was on pole because they could sustain qualifying. Mm-hmm. Both times, he then spun out of control in the races.
Jeez.
So that was the precursor as to where we get to this photo, right? Yeah. Then came the story of Imola. So that was the San Marino Grand Prix back then. It was probably one of the darkest weekends of Formula One racing. In the pre-qualifiers, should forget his name now. An Austrian guy actually lost his life. So Roland Ratzenberger was doing testing, spun out, hit the wall, and unfortunately he died. And Senna was quite close to this guy. So what he did was that he actually jumped into one of the sort of race vehicles that was by the track. Yeah. He drove straight to the crash to go be with this guy. Yeah. And then they rushed to the hospital. Senna was with him the whole time. And the Formula FIA has their own surgeon, physician kind of guy. Yeah. And quite strangely said to him after this, because the guy just died, okay? Yeah. It's a big deal. Said to Eton, you've done everything you need to do in the sport. You can walk away today and everyone will still think you're a hero. You can spend the rest of your life fishing, do whatever you need to do. Yeah. And he's like, I need a race. Very next day. So Rubens Barrichello at the time, obviously also being Brazilian, was the protege of Ayrton Senna. And he also had a near fatal crash, same thing. So going into this race, Senna didn't like the car, didn't feel safe in the car. There had been one fatality, one near fatality.
Jeez.
And it wasn't like there was a race briefing. Senna was really upset because of the death of this guy, and there was so much controversy going into this race. Then the race starts. As it starts, massive crash. Wheel goes into the fucking crowd. Eight people need to be rushed off to hospital.
Oh, jeez. Oh.
Guys, it gets
this race.
Guys, it gets worse. So now we're in safety mode, right? And this isn't the time of like the latest Aston Martin going flat out to guide the cars around. An Opel Vectra. A fucking Opel Vectra is at the front. Is the front guiding the guys around? So Senna's in pole, and he drives next to the guy and goes, go faster," because as you know, with the cars, they need to keep the heat up.
Yeah,
they need to keep heating the tires, all that kind of stuff. And the Oak is redlining this Vectra.
He's
driving like a mum's car. He's redlining this thing, and eventually the race gets underway. They manage to do one lap. And then Michael Schumacher was behind Ayrton as they were going into this bend. As they get to this corner, the guys are doing about 300 kilometers an hour.
Lost control. Boom.
Tires weren't right. Steering basically failed him on that sort of moment. And as much as he tried to like get out of it, he hit the wall 211 kilometers an hour. But he hit a concrete wall.
Oh.
So the sort of post-crash forensics came out. Basically, his right wheel went straight into his head, and a piece of the suspension actually pierced his helmet. Great. So he was responsive when the guys got to him.
But bit of time.
The medics, they managed to remove his helmet. He looked up. He then sighed. And then the same guy who told him that you should probably not race anymore, he was by his side, and the same dude was with him. And he said, when he sighed, I felt a weight lifted, as in like his spirit left his body.
Ooh.
This is the FIA's full-time surgeon, physician person. He was close with Ayrton. And that was that. That was the end of Ayrton Senna.
Jeez.
It's a hell of a story.
I'm not going to Imola for the Grand Prix in terms of the I'm good, thank you.
Yeah, guys, it was race three of the season. He spun out because the car wasn't reliable, and then it all just sort of came to be. It was really sad. And a guy called Angelo Orsi.
This picture's awesome.
So that was the general picture that was taken at the time. A guy called Angelo Orsi then took pictures of Senna with his helmet off. And to this day, the only people that have seen that photo is Angelo Orsi himself and Senna's family.
Oof.
No one else has seen these pictures. They've never been released. And thankfully, after that, Formula One made a whole bunch of changes.
Had to.
A whole bunch of safety recommendations came through after that.
It's one of those ones where, like, the sad part is obviously the changes come. It takes something, a fatality like that, where you go, okay, maybe now it's time to make those changes. I mean, like, if you feel no one, remember a couple of years ago when Max and Lewis had that incident where the tire was almost. Yeah. And you think to yourself, like, as much as you take for granted, as crashes happen, like, you think, like, someone could easily spit out and just die. Like, because imagine sitting there on TV, you literally just watch someone die. Like, yeah.
Cooks, I'm glad you bring that up, because if you think about it, you're going at all these hectic speeds and your head is exposed.
Yeah.
So Formula One's next fatality came in 2014, Jules Bianchi in the Japanese Grand Prix. So he basically spun out, and because his head was exposed, he spun out into like a, you know, like the big forklift that picks the car up.
Yeah.
He spun out into that in the wet, and through pure like head trauma, he died. And that, on the back of that, they then created that halo.
Yeah.
And that halo has been one of the greatest innovations.
Yeah.
So now if something does come towards your head, at least you'll have a deflecting device.
That's scary. I mean, geez, that is.
Yeah, guys. So from head trauma and ultimate death to perhaps the most famous use of head, famous use of a head in football. Photo number five is 2006 FIFA World Cup final. We've got a lot of FIFA World Cup finals in here. Oh. It was Zinedine Zidane's headbutt on Marco Materazzi.
If there was ever a time I wanted one of the GOATs to show a level of composure, was this moment.
Do you know what's funny about that? I was in grade six. I still remember watching it, because like on the build up, it was when the games happening. You don't actually see it happening.
Yeah.
You're sort of watching, and it was one of those ones where like you're waiting for it to get to penalties, and like it's a bit of a lull in the game, and I just remember you hear the commentator going, my old man had gone to the kitchen, is just like, okay, cool, like make him coffee, like he comes back and he goes, I'm like, what's going on? I'm like, I think Zidane just got a red card. And then he's like, for what? I'm like, no, I knew. And then you look back and you're like, oh, he headbutted him. Because also, like I said, you just seem so random. Like, there's no like, there was much niggle in the game. Or like, there was like, you just like one moment, then he's headbutted him and he walks past him. And then there's another picture from this video when he walks past the World Cup.
I was going to say that probably it's the most
That was his last game.
That's how he bowed out of international football.
Yeah.
So, okay, there's a couple of things that lead up to this. Firstly, as you say, Zinedine Zidane was the mercurial best. He really was. It was so weird watching him. It's like he had more time than everyone else.
Yeah,
100%.
He really was quite something. And the Italians, when they were watching the matches going to the final, because they were there, and they were hoping to get Brazil, basically anybody other than France, because Zidane was that good.
Mm.
And Materazzi and his fellow defenders were cucking themselves rightfully about this. Okay, so the game starts out. It's like any other World Cup final. It's really big stakes. Everyone's a little bit nervous. Materazzi gives away the penalty. Dubious call. It was a bit touch and go. Zidane steps up.
Paneka.
With the most audacious Paneka ever. In a final. And what Materazzi said is that it was very clear the way he took that penalty, his intentions for that game. He wanted to make it about his greatest performance, and he wanted to bow out a legend, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And then as the game wore on, Materazzi actually came back and redeemed himself by scoring the equalizer.
Oh, he scored the header.
Yeah, he scored the header
over
Patrick Vieira. He was known for his aerial prowess. And he was also known at the time for saluting the sky, because he lost his mom when he was 15. Yeah. I'll tell you, that's going to come back in a bit of a story. He lost his mom when he was 15, and he really felt in that moment that she was with him. So it was a very emotional moment for Materazzi as well, because then it was back to level pegging. Then it got into the business end of things, right? And Zidane was firing. It was a guy who wanted to close the game out.
Yeah.
And Materazzi's teammate, Rino Gattuso, he couldn't mark Zidane. He was like, fuck, this looks just too good.
OG Gattuso.
He was struggling.
Yeah.
He was absolutely struggling. So he said to Materazzi, look, I'm having a fucking cuck time here. Please mark Zidane. So he did. He applied himself to it to the point where he was tugging shirts. He was doing whatever he could. So then Zidane said to him, because he's all over him, you know, went into the box, then goalkeeper got the ball. As they're running out of the box, Zidane said to Materazzi, if you want my shirt that badly, just ask me after the game. To which Materazzi back, like a full-on banter, said, I'd rather have your sister.
Oh.
And that's where the trouble started. So what Materazzi thought was, some playful banter amongst Oaks.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good line, to be honest.
Yeah, to be 100%.
I'd rather have your sister. Yeah. It's playful. Didn't mean anything by it. But what happened the day of the final was that so Dan's mom was really ill. And he was chatting to his sister throughout the day because the sister was with the mom, the poorly mom. Mm. And clearly it was a wrong time to bring up anyone in Zidane's family.
Yeah.
And that's what happened, right? Now Zidane is fucking triggered. He is now ready to fucking go. And out of nowhere, there was a fellow defender on the field said, I didn't see it, but I heard it. The whole headbutt on the chest thing. The thing is, nobody else saw it, Cooks. It wasn't just your dad who missed it. On your dad saw as much of it as the referee.
Because we were following the ball at that time,
So, Matarazzi hits the deck. Something's happened to the Oak.
Yeah.
And back in those days, there was no VAR.
Yeah.
The cameras weren't that great.
Yeah.
But the fourth official on the day apparently saw it on the monitor. So, Matarazzi's on the ground.
Yeah.
The linesman didn't see anything. The referee didn't see anything. But there's a guy on the ground, right? Now the crowds are fucking cheering. Everyone's going off. The replay comes back.
Oh.
And now we see what's happened. But because the fourth official said, yes, I saw it, he then stopped the play to flag it. Yeah. And as we know from there, Zidane got sent off.
Ruined.
But true to the nature of the man, have you ever seen a more charismatic form of violence?
Yeah.
He said, I'm leaving with something. That's what he said.
You see the push, you see a punch. But just like... a headbutt, and the thing is, and calculate on, like on the chest, like even go for his face. Like, I'm not gonna break your nose. I'm trying to break your sternum, basically.
But just, I mean, if you got to be watching the show on like visually to get the most out of this. But look at his post impact pose.
He went through, and that's Matarazzi's not a small guy, guys.
He hit him, and Matarazzi, like you expect a guy to maybe like flip you in the balls or maybe like push you or whatever. You don't expect a fucking forehead to the sternum.
Oh,
but look at his weight distribution. Yeah. Look how poised he is. And like a guy who grew up rough, look at his right hand. It's clenched.
Just in case
the headbutt didn't work first. It's like he's ready for
it. Exactly. He's ready. And this again, guys, as you pointed out, this was his last act at international football as a professional. So the aftermath of this picture is quite interesting. Obviously, they go on to the penalty shootout. Zidane's not there to take it. Matarazzi takes his penalty. He gets it.
Yeah.
Italy win 2006 World Cup champions.
All she wrote.
The aftermath of this picture is almost better than the whole thing. So Matarazzi is then labeled by all these newspapers as being a racist, antagonizing Zidane's mom.
Yeah.
All these kind of slurs come out about how he targeted Zidane and incited the violence here. So he took them all to court, and he managed to win libel cases against all those trashy tabloids in the UK.
Shout out to him.
He also said at the time, it's like, I would never insult someone's mother. Because he lost his mom when he was 15, that was very sacred for him. Yeah. So he would never have ever, ever in his whole life have been so disrespectful to another person's mother. It was a pure bit of banter around a sister. It was a sister joke. Poorly timed. Matarazzi got a 2-match suspension on the back of that. Zidane got 3 days of community service because he'd retired.
He's like,
it's so wild for Matarazzi. How do I get suspended?
I'm the victim here.
Guys, it gets worse. He had post-World Cup, because he had not seen his family, the Oak had planned an entire trip to Euro Disney in Paris.
No, bro,
don't go out in public in France right now.
It's not the time for you to be going to Euro Disney.
So this poor guy spent the next like 2 years of his life as the guy who got headbutted.
Yeah.
And he was the victim here, but he was the villain. Everyone hated him. Like, then they actually made a statue of the whole thing.
That is news to me. I never knew that they made a statue.
So they made a statue, and the picture we're showing you here is the Qatar World Cup. It was put out in like a fan area.
Qatar, we got money to play with, but that's crazy.
But now it's part of like some FIFA memorabilia. But look how big the statue is. Look at the guys below it.
Yeah.
So it'll always be immortalized as the greatest headbutt, I think, in any sport. And then Sepp Blatter actually wanted to use it as a PR stunt to pre-2010. So obviously coming to South Africa... Sepp Blatter had this idea. I shit you not. He had this great idea because they didn't make up or anything. There wasn't any publicly strange of no worries, mate, in the heat of the battle thing. Sepp Blatter said the two of them should go to Robben Island in the build-up to 2010 FIFA World Cup.
Of course.
Don't drag Nelson into this now.
I shit you not. This was Sepp Blatter's major idea of reconciliation pre-2010 World Cup.
I feel him, though.
It didn't happen.
It would have been great for football.
City does Mandela itself for 27 minutes. As opposed to 27 years, just sit there.
Just the two of them sitting there together, just like arm in arm. Yeah. So apparently, there was like a sort of coming together. Materazzi really wanted to shake his hand, look him in the eye. And for him, he was over it. He was really sorry. Apparently, Zidane, not so much.
Well, I mean, I've seen him in interviews saying he regrets nothing. Yeah. Zidane, so he's like, I'll do it again if needs be.
Zidane, ultimate competitor. But what's crazy is that it never diminished Zidane's legacy.
Which is kind of weird because that's
how GOAT you got to be. Do those craziness.
Well said. That's how GOAT you got to be, that your last action football is
this in a World Cup final.
And everyone almost like celebrates that, with Materazzi, then.
Talk about my mother one more time, I dare you.
Yeah, so now we can clear it up. Mothers were not used, but the biggest takeout here is that that was actually the first VAR situation in the world.
I mean, the England guys must be so upset about that they couldn't get one. That's the one they chose.
But also, I would love to be like at the stadium seeing that, because it's all those things, you're watching a live game. Certain things, you pick up certain things that maybe something catches your eye. You're looking. And you go I just think Zidane headbutted this. It was like, no, you're lying. I'm like, I promise you.
That's what this red card's going.
He floored him with a headbutt. It was absolute box office. That really was. And maybe some people will say it's karma, but Italy didn't even make it to the next World Cup.
Karma.
They weren't even in 2010.
Yeah, I think it's karma.
I don't understand how that worked, but I remember that being a thing. All right, next photo. We're going to go to the world of cricket. 2007 Cricket World Cup. The biggest moment of the entire thing was with the biggest man, Dwayne Leverock's catch.
Catches with matches, as they would say.
Guys, this is one of the coolest stories in cricket. So Dwayne, as you can see there, a hulking man, around 140 kilograms. When he wasn't taking amazing slip catches, he was bowling some pretty piss-poor off-spin. And he was also a policeman and prison van driver.
Wow.
So in this
multiple streams, as they would say.
Match, they played against India. This was early on, right? Yeah. Robin Utapa, he went out for three, floored basically from the catch. India went on to post 413 for five. So the two guys in the story here, Utapa, he was the only guy that failed with a bat. Yeah. Dwayne went on to take 1 for 96 in his 10. So outside of this picture, not great. But he was known as Sluggo, obviously a bit of a legend around Bermuda.
Yeah.
And there was this guy, he was a cricket fan, he was a tourist in Bermuda. He got into a taxi one day, this was like 2 years ago. He got into a taxi driver's like, hey, I see you're in Bermuda, what you here for? He's like, no, I've always seen it, heard about the place, I like cricket, so I'm in the West Indies, I'm doing a tour. He's like, oh, you like cricket? What do you think about Bermuda cricket team? So he's like,
he'll be like,
Dwayne Leverock.
What ifs? Yeah.
Dwayne Leverock, a big hero, whatever. Yeah. He's like, Dwayne Leverock, let's see if we can find him.
Oh.
Taxi driver gets on the call to his wife, okay, and says, honey, do you know anyone on the island that knows Dwayne Leverock? I've got a cricket fan in my taxi right now. Love to meet him. 5 minutes later, they find Dwayne Leverock's number. So now they give him a call. Big Dwayne answers, hello, how can I help? He's like, Dwayne, where are you? I've got a cricket fan who really wants to meet you. So they do. 5 minutes later, they're at Dwayne Leverock's house.
That is madness.
So I've got a picture here of, this is the guy. There he is.
Oh.
So this cricket fan goes and takes some photos of Dwayne reenacting the thing. As you can see, he didn't put the knife and fork down after his playing. But now this picture goes into a local newspaper. It becomes like stuff of legend. Cricket fan meets Dwayne Leverock.
Yeah.
So then Dwayne, they have a long chat. He's just the nicest guy in real life, as you would imagine. Dwayne jokingly says to this dude, it'd be really funny if you had to meet Robin Utapa one day and tell him about us talking about this. Yeah. A year later, guy over there with a beard, he is watching T10 in Miami. As he arrives, goes to his hotel reception. Who's there? Robin Utapa.
Of course.
I mean, the joy in Robin Utapa's face there in the story.
So this is like our mate Josh.
Yeah, I was gonna say this is such a Josh thing to happen.
So you see the book there.
Yeah.
He's basically got the newspaper cutout of him meeting Dwayne Leverock, and now he's showing Robin Utapa about how Dwayne said, I should tell you, I should remind you about this.
Josh got to come out with a book like this. I think we can work on that.
I mean, my favorite is look at, I mean, I'm sure if you're watching it, but Robin Utapa's face is It's as if he's asked him the day of the innings, like as he's walked out, like, hey, do you mind if I take a picture of you and talk about the?
This is like someone like asking Alan Donald what happened in 1999. It's like it's a pretty rough thing to do, but apparently Robin Tapa was in such great spirits.
Are you sure?
So no, he was not in the photo, but you know he spoke about the fact that you know in that 2007 World Cup, India didn't make it to the Super Eights.
Yeah,
they were in a group that didn't. They finished third in their group, despite hammering Bermuda on the day. And it was a tough time for Indian cricket because guys were burning effigies of the players back home. It was a weird World Cup 2007.
It's such a strange World Cup.
It really was.
The final ended in the dark, pretty much, like Australia and Sri Lanka just because guys playing like six overs in the dark with the games finishing. You're like, what are you watching? You're like just.
It was really, really strange. But Dwayne was a massive sort of absolute cult hero on the back of that. It's just one of those really cool fan stories that comes out.
Catches win matches out. That's no matter who you are, where you are.
It's just like, I find it unfair, you know, sometimes. Like, you know, it's weird. Like, you know, in soccer, like, if you're the fat dog, you get put in goal. That's fine around much. But, like, you know, it's slip is you earn the right to win a slip. But, like, he's just like, he's a fat dog. So, sorry, but, like, you couldn't put you in the outfield.
You said, like, you're not going to get an edge.
Well, the thing with Dwayne, I mean, even if the ball's not seaming around, no one's seen an edge all day, he'll still be slip come over 50.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Slip come over 50.
Okay, guys, we're outside of the power play. Dwayne, stay where you are.
Yeah, just
don't do any, and no sudden movements, bro.
I mean, that's about Big Dwayne's. At least he made sure he had good hands as well.
Yeah.
But to be fair, like even from the size of his hands, like there's nothing going on in those days.
Gigantic man, huh? Sluggo, there he is.
Jesus.
It was one of those great moments. And, you know, people talk about the fact that, you know, there's too many games in these World Cups and the minnows should do their own thing. But he was an absolute shiny moment about what made that World Cup great, because there was a lot of things that made that World Cup absolutely dodgy.
Yeah, those group stages, Super 8s, which like the World Cup was almost like 3 months.
It was guys so like long. Guys started new families. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I remember reading those old SA cricket magazines, and they're like they had like a World Cup review, and they're like, and they're saying like because they played a game a day. And like it just like for some reason they refused to play like two games, and it was something like 3 months. Yeah. It was like you're sitting there like, okay, like when do we get like to the semis? And obviously like it's like a random time. And, like Bob will pass away the World Cup as
mysteriously.
Well. Yeah, mysteriously, like it was death. So you're like
it was just dark.
It was just dark.
Yeah, guys, it was pretty rough. All right, let's lighten the load on that. Photo number 7 takes us to tennis. This is one of the most iconic photos, I think, from Wimbledon in a very odd way. Dimitri actually submitted this photo. This is a big favorite of his. There's Maria Sharapova leaving the court, and what often happens in Wimbledon, a rain delay, as you see the covers coming up, and as you see every single person holding a cover.
Taking a look-see.
So Maria Sharapova, she won Wimbledon 2004. Not my cup of tea. I thought she was hugely boring. And also, unlucky for her, she was in the time of Serena, so she probably could have won more.
Yeah.
But she got trampled by the goat quite often. So there's a couple of things that I find interesting about this photo. The obvious aside, all of those oaks are having a bit of a slow day and having a look at
I think she was just 18 when she won. I was like, it'll be tough when the oaks look at that.
The oaks are, oaks are conflicted, yeah.
The oaks are a little bit conflicted. But the point that stands out the most for me is color. I mean, I like the visual form. I do photography and all these kind of things. For me, it's so powerful because you've got the white of the player and everything else is so green. And one of the major reasons that Wimbledon wants all their players in white is for this exact reason, so that the players and the tennis actually stands out.
Yeah.
And you think like, oh yeah, that actually makes perfect sense. But back in the day, going back to where Wimbledon started, 1870, the Victorian era, it was very like low class to be seen as perspiring. So if you were doing any sort of physical pursuit, very light clothing was great because then you couldn't see your sweat marks.
Yeah.
Also like, fuck, that makes so much sense. And all tennis tournaments, actually, most of the players predominantly wore white. The US Open had its own all-white policy.
No, Ben, I'd be learning stuff from you.
So am I. So then, obviously, what happened was that things got a little more colorful in the disco era. Yeah. So from 1972 onwards, the US Open was like, wear what you want.
Yeah.
Go mad. Wimbledon was like,
nah.
No. Prior to that, what really actually made Wimbledon double down on this whole thing is that it was seen as common decency that you would wear light clothing. But then Brazil's Maria Bueno was very no bueno when she just rocked up in a very colorful samba outfit. And they were like, nope. The fuck you wearing that? And then it became an actual hard and fast rule in 62. So in the 70s and 80s, players try to rebel a bit. Andre Agassi famously didn't even go to Wimbledon in the 80s because his whole thing was color and being larger than life. And they were like, okay, cool.
Cheers. Sweet. Thanks for coming, buddy.
No worries. And then, you know, like Roger Federer once wore shoes that had orange soles. And they said to him, Roger, no.
Doing too much right now.
Like, it's not very gentlemanly. Please have white-soled shoes. And it really became a thing. So I'm in a position where I look at this and I go, you know, that's cool. Wimbledon's been around since 1800s. Mm. Yeah. They can make a few rules, right? Especially when, like, the idea behind it was so honorable. They want the tennis players to stand out.
Yeah.
But nowadays, where people feel that they can fucking...
do whatever.
Challenge everything, argue everything. They said, no, these rules are too restrictive, blah, blah, blah. I think to hell with that. Let Wimbledon be Wimbledon. It looks really cool when everyone's in white. And it really stands out. One of the latest sort of changes to that is that women have been allowed to wear darker colored undershorts underneath their skirts in the fear that during menstrual cycles, wearing pure white is not practical. I'm not making this up.
I mean, they're getting with the times. Right?
That was
I just had a child of 12. That's not bad.
That was the only challenge to the rules based on that. Otherwise, you have to wear.
Shout out Wimbledon for being woke on that one. Shout out. I feel you.
Guys, that came in at 2023. Women have been menstruating since, I promise you, the beginning. I'm no gynecologist, but I'll tell you what.
My favorite thing is like, in 2023, so I was like, guys, we've got to figure something out here. But like, I just love.
That was a fun video.
No, but I 100% agree with you. Like, you know, like, you still want these traditions, right, in sports. And like, Wimbledon is probably the biggest Grand Slam. It's the only one played on grass. Yeah. And it's got a prestige about it. Like, it's just fucking wear what? Like people are like, why must you, people like complain now, like you've been playing, like, why must it change with you if the Pete Sampras, the guys, the GOATs have applied this whole rules, they knew.
Even Agassi came around.
Even Agassi came around.
He was front row in white.
And then like guys come now and be like, oh no, like I just think it's too restrictive. Like, then don't play. Like,
all the manufacturers are more than happy to make white outfits for you guys because it's that one time of the year. I mean, Shaz, you've been to a few parties. How cool are all white parties?
Shout out to that. Way to play that in there. But I love, you know, the Wimbledon. I think, you know, it's strange to say it, but I love the discipline of how Wimbledon does it.
Yeah.
You know, the formalities of, in a world where everybody can do whatever they want, I really like the formality of Wimbledon. It gives it a certain prestige, elevates it. And when you have like a great final like we just had and all those iconic pictures that you get out of that, oh man, it's such a strange thing to say because I'm all about like do your thing. But Wimbledon, just keep Wimbledon. I'm okay with that.
I think it's also one of the few like sporting tournaments where you kind of like I would say, like I kind of give a shit like which celebrities are going to go watch. Quite cool. Like you see, like David Beckham in a suit, and you see, this, and you're like, but they did it in a way where it's also it feels like class. It's not just hey, look, watch an NFL game. Yeah, it's Taylor Swift. You're like, can you go back to that? Where it's like it's just done properly, like how they introduce the champions and
Which is cool. I mean, people do a lot about this whole like everyone must do their own thing. Shows, as you point out, but we must also remember and actually hold dear that if something's been around forever, your opinion today means very little after 100 and however many years of tradition and hard work, quite frankly. Yeah. They worked hard to make Wimbledon what it is, and it's an incredible spectacle. We've got to respect tradition more. As a fan, you can't just rock up in a Speedo and with like face paint on. They will tell you to get lost.
Yeah.
And if you are in the royal box or any of those kind of boxes, you ladies are not to wear hats because you don't want to obscure the view.
Yeah. And then somebody pop champagne. We saw that guy. I felt so bad. Like, pop champagne, the cork landed. Like, but you will still have your nuance if you go to Wimbledon, guys. You'll still have a lot of fun.
Look, it's one of those events that I really want to go to. Same. It's shit expensive, but I'm determined to go to Wimbledon one day. I would love to. And I'm going to dress up.
Yeah.
I'm going to dress up. I'll have my full head of hair there as well.
Oh, shut up.
It's going to be happening. Also, off-white and cream were never allowed to be worn as well.
Is there like adjustment now? Or is it still pure?
It's still pure.
I remember, I think Yannick Sinner had to get special permission for one of his bags he had. I think he had like a Louis Vuitton, and it's like off-white. You also had to get like special permission to get...
No, it is. All those things. Accessories. If you have tremendous need for strapping, the strapping needs to be white unless it's something you cannot avoid.
Well, it's classic Nikeros. I mean, remember when he went to the final and he kept wearing the Jordan Jordan ones,
yes,
the red and white,
yes.
And he kept getting fines. He's like, I'll keep paying the fines, keep paying fines. And a part of me goes like I mean, I'm all for Nick Carroll, but like this is like just a tradition, like to be a dick one less month, like to be a dick for 1 less month.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and Jordan Brand would have given him the white on white,
and they would have made something special around that. Again, it just comes back to the fact that you are not bigger than Wimbledon.
Yeah,
it's. I think we should all appreciate that. Yeah. It's like you're just not bigger than it. So apply by this because it's a privilege to actually be there amongst the history. All right, in a very different direction, photo number 8 for this episode is UFC 229, the day that Conor McGregor's career died and his soul was ripped from his body by Khabib Nurmagomedov.
This is where he broke the leg.
No, we'll get to that. But what makes this photo so incredible is it's literally just after Khabib has applied a neck crank, which is then submitted to McGregor. Khabib becomes the lightweight champion of the world in the UFC. McGregor is sitting there forlorn, and all shit is about to erupt.
Because he goes, finds the brew.
Exactly. Yeah. From this moment, okay. Now, if you watch a lot of UFC or any kind of fighting, you know when the fight ends, the fight ends. Yeah. No, a new fight started here.
Yeah, he went to find Conor's guy. He was talking crazy.
Khabib jumped over the fence here, got involved, sort of fighting in the crowd. Khabib's other team then jumps over the fence into the octagon and starts fighting McGregor. McGregor actually lands some of his best shots after this moment. Yeah. All hell is broken loose.
I just love the fact, my favorite thing about that is, instead of Khabib's team joining and fighting, I was like, sorry, they're like, there's that Conor bitch.
Yeah. No, but Conor was wild.
There's you. We're gonna finally get him. And like, Pork's tired. He's, you're fighting like 4 or 5 guys.
Yeah. Who are coming from all directions. And the referee is not exactly administering any sort of decorum here.
I felt Khabib on this one, because this is when Conor was talking to you. I felt like he crossed the line on the PR.
So exactly. I think Matarazzi has been cleared on the show. Yeah. We cannot clear McGregor, unfortunately.
Yeah, Conor was like, I get it. We're going for the PR vibe on the boxing. But he went too far when he started talking about religion. His religion.
He did.
And his family.
So just to wind back a little bit here, this fight was UFC, to this day, the biggest pay-per-view fight.
Really?
2.4 million pay-per-view sales. As we know, McGregor is the biggest name in UFC. He still to this day
holds... McGregor post-Mayweather fight. I think his first fight after...
This was correct.
Yeah, just after leaving.
So just to give you some context about how big McGregor was at the time, he's still to this day, he's the top 5 selling pay-per-views of UFC's history. But he came into the sport with the nickname Mystic Mac because he literally just predicted what he was going to do to guys. And he flew all the way up. He became the featherweight champion. He became the lightweight champion. He was the first double champ. As in, he had 2 belts. He fucked everyone up and he was the guy. But then it all went to his head hugely and up his nose. Yeah. But the whole thing was that when you're in the UFC, you are only ever going to fight in the UFC. But him and Dana cooked up this idea that he was then going to go fight Floyd Mayweather.
Yeah.
So as we know, that fight became everything for like a 2-year period, all the hype. Mm. In the process, McGregor became inactive in the UFC. So he was stripped of his featherweight title and of his lightweight title. In the process of him becoming a multimillionaire and a coke addict and fighting Mayweather, in what was nothing more than an exhibition that Floyd allowed him to get to, and 10 rounds in.
And then Floyd carried that fight. Yeah.
Floyd basically played with him for 10 rounds and then decided to end it.
Yeah.
But McGregor took himself very seriously with that. Yeah. And then he thought, okay, I'm coming back to the UFC. In the interim, Khabib Nurmagomedov has gone through everybody.
And he's cleaning them out.
He is like the boogeyman. He's unstoppable. He's just, he's incredible. Unbeaten all the way through. So now there's bad blood because now Khabib's camp is now having a fight with McGregor's camp. Because everyone's got an entourage, right? So there were some face-offs in some hotel lobbies around the world. McGregor saw this and he decided to fly to wherever Khabib and his team were. And he then attacked the tour bus with a trolley. He threw this fucking thing through the window, plate glass window, whatever. There was injuries to the guys inside. Now the bad blood was on. Now the fight was on. But as you said, he then starts going on about his religion. He started insulting mothers. Yeah. He started doing all these different things. Khabib wanted to actually kill the guy.
Yeah.
So the fight that ended up happening on UFC 229 in 2018 was fueled by absolute rage, vengeance, and hatred like no one else ever seen in a fight.
Yeah.
And that's where it all came to be. It came to a head. McGregor got taken out, and that's when his career actually died. It really did.
Yeah, because he's never been the same after that. And like, you look at Khabib, like, you look at, I mean, like, you know, his career was, he obviously loved to fight because his dad told him to fight, and he believed that that's what he's put on earth to do, was to fight. And then
the Dagestani way.
Yeah, the Dagestani way. And I mean, like, and every single fight besides the McGregor fight, it's, you know, he would, you know, you shake hands with a guy, respectful. I mean, when you choked out Justin Gaethje, he's like, well, if I put him in this lock, I'm going to hurt him. And I saw his dad, so I put him in another one just because.
Yeah, it's like, I didn't want to break his arm in front of his parents.
So I'm just going to choke him out. So I know you'll tap to this.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And then with Conor, like, when you watch the fight, I mean, you can see him, like, almost strangling him and talking to Dana White. I'm like I'm going to smash your boy. Like, this is.
Yep.
And he's going to him, and you're like, he doesn't even care about the title. He doesn't care. He's just like, I'm going to fuck this all up. That's all I basically want. I'm like, and I've got the means to do it. And I'm like, there was no way they could fight. Like, I was like, oh, they should have a rematch. Like, they couldn't fight again. They killed each other.
Well, Conor wanted a rematch, based on what I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
Khabib was kind of over it because, firstly, when he got back to Dagestan, his dad fucked him up.
Yeah.
Basically, his dad said, when he gets home, he's going to get punished.
Yeah, yeah. Because this is madness.
Madness. He jumped the fence. He acted like an absolute clown.
Yeah.
But caught up in the moment. So I think his dad knocked him around a little bit. He came back. It's, you know, he said,
yeah, I got to relax now.
Yeah.
And what's cool about this fight, I think it built the cult hero-ness of what Khabib would be. I see recently he was in Cape Town, and I think it's like
the PFL,
the PFL. Mm. And like, the fans loved him. He just spoke for like 2 minutes how great Cape Town was, but it built the idea of Khabib, and it built odd, you know, because we've been dealing with a lot of classless champions, of how classly, like, he can handle
classless champions and John Jones. I agree.
Yeah. But also, I mean, but you can't not, like, appreciate what Conor did to the sport, for the sport. I mean, he was an absolute rock star.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and he was funny. And I mean, yeah, there was but you said, like, there's a line which you cross. But I mean, he's still, like, sold, I mean, he's still pay per views, and you wanted to watch him. And, like, if, like, even when he came back, I mean, after that, obviously, you said his career, it was never the same after the Khabib fight. But even when he came back, he'll still have to be the main event, because most people are watching, you know, watch Conor.
Yeah.
And even if you fight now, people, like, the appeal of him, they'll still go, I want to see what is happening. Conor's fighting. It's gonna sell more pay-per-views.
He's a box office person.
Yeah.
I think the most famous photo involving him is him at his lowest. And that's almost ironic in itself, because it's kind of what he deserves in the end. Yeah. He's a bit of a shit.
Yeah.
If he's not flashing his meat on social media, he's beating women, or, like, there's a lot of stuff around Conor which isn't great. So I'm never going to endorse the guy as a person, but
he is blockbuster, yeah.
But like, that photo, you can see that, like, that was the end of his career, because he came back, he fought Donald Cerrone and he won, but Donald Cerrone was on his way out. He's looking for a payday. He then decided he was going to fight against Dustin Poirier, his little buddy. Poirier beats him. Suddenly he hates Poirier. Poirier beats him again, and now he's just talking shit about his wife.
Yeah.
He then goes on this long tirade with Michael Chandler. They're on the Ultimate Fighter series, strings him along for 2 years. They never fight. He's in and out of the drug testing pool. He's in and out of court. The Oak is an absolute fucking mess.
Movies.
And now at the age of 37, he is retired. He's not retired. People actually don't care as much. But in that moment, and it's 2018, huh?
Yeah.
That's how long ago it is now, 2018. All right, guys, moving on to probably the least known of the photos for today, but maybe one of the better ones.
That shock you.
Morteza Merazitslankjani. Ever heard of this guy?
I want to be honest with you.
There he is.
Wow.
He's the tall guy in the picture. Morteza.
Wow.
Morteza there is the second tallest man on earth. He's 8 foot tall.
You play basketball, or is he playing volleyball?
Kooks, you want to take a guess what his sport is?
I feel like it's going to be something around. Like, is it?
Okay, so he's a Paralympian, obviously. He had as you see, he's leaning a little bit there, which means he's not as tall. But he had a bike accident when he was younger, and his right leg stopped growing. He was born with giganticism? A condition where you're bigger than everyone else.
Yeah, pretty much.
Any guess what his sport is?
Oh, my God.
You've thrown me off because I threw the
ball. I mean, you've given me... You've
got volleyball? I think something like badminton or something.
Sitting volleyball.
Had to be.
But even when he's sitting, he's still fucking 6 foot.
It's shucks.
So this Oak, born with gigantism.
Yeah.
He was like an outsider here, like a real outlier in Iran. And he appeared on a TV show out of the blue. And legendary sitting volleyball coach, Hadi Razai,
said, that's my guy.
He said, this oak might be pretty handy in my sport. So he found him and he convinced him to become a sitting volleyball player.
Yeah.
How well do you think he did?
Yeah,
he came into the Paralympic team. Iran has won 3 gold medals in a row now.
Shout out. You know what? Shout out to the coach on that
it's
one.
Just like, it's just, I just feel like it's just so unfair. Like, yeah. You just put him in the net and he's just like this. And he's like, what do we do against this?
Flex, I think we got another picture there of him actually in action. You can maybe just see.
I mean.
So sitting volleyball is a Paralympic sport, obviously, with people with like various injuries
insane.
That they can't stand and move around.
Picture.
So when this oak's at the net, he's still the biggest oak in the world.
Also, at the back, he's basically just lobbing over everyone. And it's like, he's like, there you go. And like, you're like, what are we doing here?
I mean, as pictures go in sport, this is one of my favorites. So shout out to this oak.
This is just
Morteza. And
Morteza, you're my guy right now.
So he's won 3 Olympic Paralympic golds now because he is the biggest, he's second tallest man on the planet. But not all glamorous going to the Paralympics if you're him. Because he's so big, they can't find beds for him. So he spent more nights on the floor in the Olympic Village than in a bed. Because he gets there and he gets given a room and there's normal beds. And
they're like,
well, I mean, so, the last Olympics is those cardboard beds. Yeah. So like,
so eventually they managed to construct a bed for him halfway through the Paris Paralympics. But he spent a lot of time on the floor. And being such a humble guy, I mean, I don't know where they found this oak, but he was quite happy just to be out of the spotlight. He slept on the floor, no problem. But they eventually built him a bed.
He's just a three-time champ, at least. It's the least we can do.
You just feel bad when you're doing like the measurements and like, and you're just like, hey guys, do you have a bed for someone who's 8 foot?
Yeah.
So wait, you said he's the second tallest person in the world.
There is a taller person than him.
So he's what, 7?
He's eight foot one, 2.46 meters. Yeah, and obviously he was born with this syndrome that makes you so much bigger. And he's the greatest guy that sitting volleyball has ever seen. He's the LeBron of sitting volleyball.
Like, what do you do? Like, I just think it's just like, there comes a point where like, other countries like, sorry, like we need a height limit to this thing.
Because this is how stuff gets bigger.
Even if he played normal volleyball, like, and it was like, coach, we still can't do anything in the circle.
Yeah, he's actually a perfect storm. I mean, he had a bike injury, so then he can't actually walk properly. So then he's in the Paralympics. Imagine like you spend your entire life wanting to become a sitting volleyball great, and you're playing against Mort Misok straight up.
So, oh my goodness!
All right, on to our last photo for this episode,
sir.
We're going back to football and one of the most amazing moments in Sandile Shangasi's life.
Let's see, which one is it?
It is, of course, the 1999 treble-winning goal by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Ben, you missed me this
ben
much.
Ben has given you a gift chip.
Oh.
It's such a beautiful photo because, as you know, Oliver Kahn is in goals there.
Yeah.
It's a great photo.
Prime of his life, the lion of the German team. It's deep in injury time. I mean, Shaz, actually, you know what? Talk me through the moment.
I can't say like I was there, but my brother was watching this final. I will never forget. And we dropped the first goal, and the game is done. And then Teddy Sheringham, by hook or by crook, gets an equalizer. Now
they weren't the best goals, but
no, you got to win them.
It was like a rolling mall of goals.
Yeah, Sheringham scored 100%. And the corner, David Beckham runs and takes this corner, and there's a header, and you think they're gonna clear it. But then it lands at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was a sub.
A late sub.
I think Sir Alex was like, well, we're here now. And
send on Frodo.
And then that's the greatest tap-in in, you know, Champions League history. And that's it.
It's a great photo because it's right there. It is a tap-in. It's a reflection. It's all instinct at that stage. The ball gets whipped in, as you said. Yeah. You're expecting it to be cleared. Bayern's got 2 men on the line. And Oliver Kahn, and somehow he finds a gap between that. And the rest is history, as they say.
First
English team to ever win the treble. So if you're unsure what the treble is, it is, of course, the league title. So they won the Premier League. It is the League Cup. It's the English Cup, FA Cup. And the Champions League trophy. Interesting season for them because they only lost 5 matches in the entire season. Obviously, they lost to Arsenal, Community Shield, Charity Shield, whatever it's called.
Whatever.
They lost in the equivalent back then of the Carabao Cup in the 5th round to Spurs, who went on to win it. Yeah. And then they lost 3 times in the league. Here's a bit of trivia for you. Who was the team that beat them at home? The only team that year?
So we're something random like Wimbledon or something.
It's giving me Derby County.
Middlesbrough.
I knew it was one of those stupid teams.
They went 33 games unbeaten in all competitions from Boxing Day in that season.
Jeez.
It really was quite something. But it was also for them in that season, it was a season of comebacks. Yeah. Because in the fourth round of the FA Cup...
Rakim not playing in this final as well.
We'll get to that in a second. Yeah. But in the FA Cup in the fourth round, they were 1-0 down to Liverpool, 89th minute. Bang, bang, 2-1, they win that injury time. Sheesh. Champions League semi-final versus Juventus. They were 2-0 down in one of the greatest games ever, actually. I know we got the picture there for the final, but the semi was really, really huge. So 2-0 down, Roy Keane gets booked early in the game. Now, as you know, when you get booked throughout of a tournament, when you reach a level of cards, you suspend it for the next game. So Keane is now out of the final. And rather than like Alex subbing him in the fear of getting a red or Keane playing it safe, he goes on to play the greatest game of his entire life. To the point that Sir Alex Ferguson writes an entire part in his book about the performance of how he led his team in that game. Yeah. And from 2-0 down to Juventus, they go on to win 3-2. Yeah. Juventus have never won a Champions League since then. Yeah. Some might say that was the Khabib Connor moment in
there. Yes, it does it.
But it was amazing. So then in that final, as you say, Keane didn't play the final.
Yeah.
Scholes didn't play the final either. Yeah. They had to put Beckham in central midfield,
yeah,
which is also quite a thing. Yeah. They had to bring in Ronnie Johnson.
Shout out Ronnie Johnson. Don't get no love. Shout out Ronnie Johnson.
Schmeichel was then captain, but they managed to get it all together. So as love him or hate him, that was one of the greatest stories at Manchester United, how they won that treble, because it wasn't exactly like they had everything going for them.
100%.
I think also that's when the stigma United sort of started of like, you know, Fergie time. And then that all is like that fear of like, oh, he's also going to find a way to score. Yeah. And it lasted like, it was 99, but even Fergie had it through his whole career where like, you play Man United, especially when you play them Old Trafford, and you're up 1-0, and you're thinking, oh, jeez, like, it's, like how are we going to hold on? They're coming in. And you actually, you blink, you go from up 1-0 to, oh, we've lost 2-1. And you think, I mean that side, I mean, arguably, even for a while, it was probably the greatest English side until, I mean...
Well, it was. Fergie time, of course, was magical. It was a few minutes. I mean, Amarim time is 90 minutes of just hell.
Yeah.
good days are coming, as I told you, as he said in his press conference. But we're not here about that. We're talking about this iconic photo, but the celebration as well.
Yep.
Peter Schmeichel's back front flip as well was crazy. There's so many iconic pictures on this final. I think Teddy Sheringham's one should have been up there as well, because the Teddy Sheringham goal gives the belief.
It does.
Because it changes the game, because Bayern Munich now becomes uber super defensive. And the breakdown, when they score, Oliver Kahn loses his mind, basically, after this. And I forgot the central midfielder as well. There's a big picture of him when he starts bawling after the final, because that's that.
It really was. It was great. I mean, most of us were far too young to know. It was back in 99. Yeah. I mean, you guys were in junior school.
Yeah.
But it was a really incredible moment. And I think a fitting picture to end part three of Sports Greatest Photos.
Yes, sir.
I mean, Cooks, we normally finish off with our own personal pictures of sports, but out of respect for Dimitri, he's not feeling so well at the moment. We're going to bypass that this time around.
Yeah.
Get well soon, Dimitri. That's obviously our big shout-out to you on this show. Shout as you can see, there's no update in his current state. This is another live picture from the hospital room.
Yeah.
As you see by his right arm there, he was at Joel's prior to this and then came in. So, yeah, I'm obviously going to go back later and get my fan back. But yeah, he'll be with us again in a few weeks to go. We've got to wrap up the show as we always do with the polls. And last week was a massive week in golf, if you're watching this now in the sort of mid-July. Scottie Scheffler blew everyone away, which was fine. Didn't fulfill him, but it made for a great tournament. So last week's poll.
Think about this, right?
We can have a sidebar about this another time. Guys, if you get me started on golf, you know you're going to have 20 minutes.
Yeah, we saw last
week. All right,
week.
So last week's poll was... What's your favorite major to watch each year in golf? No surprises, PGA Champs got all of 0%.
Jeez.
US Open got 4%. The Open got 29%. And surprisingly, OG Malefa did actually allude to it. He was on the show with us. 67% of you believe that the Masters is your favorite major to watch. It's got the Wimbledon action, eh? Yep.
I think it's the first major of the year.
Also true, eh?
Like I think that's it's just. I mean, like it's just you start the golf year starting properly. It's first major. You got hello friends, and you just got like it's just you're so excited for major season. I think that's also the appeal for it. I mean, I love the Open. I think it's like if like the time difference when we get to watch it, but it's just like nice to wake up in the morning. It's golf at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then the whole day and the conditions are tough, but. I just think, yeah, I mean, like, it's hard to talk.
But also, like, in April, it's kind of like the Easterish time.
Yeah.
There's not a whole bunch of other sports on, whereas the Open's always, like, peak summertime, right?
Yeah.
So you're competing with a lot. The Masters comes on, and all eyes are on it because of time.
Yeah, I think that's what.
And also, the Masters tells the best story.
Oh, it does.
Which we obviously had during our Masters episode this year, if you haven't seen it. This week's poll, we're going to go back because, obviously, there's a big break in the Formula One. They always take a little break because if you earn that much money, you've got to be able to use it and go on the yachts.
You know, but my
they
answer
are back.
For this.
They are back. How into the F1 season are you still is the poll this week. Your options are very sort of not at all, or I will catch up on Drive to Survive.
I'm sort of, yeah.
Sort of?
I'm on sort of as well. Sort of is just...
Look, I tell you what, the movie Formula One could not have come at a better time because right now everyone's kind of like, ugh, McLaren's going to win. Piastri, Lando, 1-2, blah, blah, blah. Hey, look, Brad Pitt. And suddenly,
look, what we got to talk about is my bro leaving Red Bull because I missed those news, you know, with him.
Christian Horner
leaving Red Bull.
Leaving or being asked to leave?
Yeah, leaving. I think that means something exciting is going to happen next season with the drivers. Because I suspect Max is out after this debacle.
I think Max stays. I think it was either like Max going either he leaves or I go. And I feel like they chose Horner. But guys,
you know what the big story is here. What will make the story funny is if Max leaves at the expense of George Russell at Mercedes.
Oh.
that's the ultimate troll, right?
Oh.
That's the ultimate Formula One troll.
We need that.
That's what we need. Drive to Survive.
Then we get like Will Buxton telling us the most random obvious facts. Because a couple of weeks ago, he put a tweet going like, "I've got news for you." That will shake. I'm like, just fucking say it. Like,
just give
like,
it.
Like, I think wasn't journalists, especially the Formula One, they love doing that. Like, something in a few weeks' time, we're going to earth shattering news.
They need a Fabrizio.
We're blowing your mind. You're like, guys, just.
Out with this. Yeah. So, look, that's Formula One. I mean, you'll get the fans that no matter what, they'll be into it. Guys like us are a bit more, maybe more casual. I've lost interest. It's just because there's also other great sport on here.
Yeah.
There's so much other great sport on.
There's no drama as well.
And there's, the takeaway, the drama. I mean, there's plenty of drama obviously coming up. We've got Rugby Championship coming up. It's a huge year of rugby. And for that, we have some absolute treats for you coming up next week. So let me take a bit of time to actually tell you how great this episode is going to be. So I have Venno Olivier in studio because he's actually got one of the best rugby careers in South African history. He was front and center at the most prime time of Super Rugby. Super Rugby was at its best during Super 14. So the two of us sit down for an hour and a half and we unpack just how great that time was. We live all the memories. And also back then, Super Rugby was the precursor to the 2010 FIFA World Cup.
Yeah.
Remember that stadium, the Orlando Stadium final?
Yeah, Orlando Stadium.
Yes.
Stormers versus the Bulls? That started the 2010 years. Mm. So I sit down with Van Anten, we go through all of that. And then we've also got John Smith coming in the next few weeks. You guys voted in that poll, the guy you want to see most. John Smith's going to be in, and we're going to talk about the 2007 World Cup. So we've got great rugby, obviously, to watch. And then as a background sort of player, we're going to give you some amazing rugby stories through some of the absolute greats. So that's future episodes of the On the Bounce show. Plus, there might be another surprise coming up in the next couple of weeks. I need to tell you about it. I haven't even told you about it yet.
That's crazy.
So much, guys, as always. So please follow the accounts on social media so then Michaela can become happy with more engagement. She's a very important part of the team. Share this with your friends, of course, because the more people share it, it's just what happens in podcast world. And the podcast gets better. Kooks, love you having you here.
Always a pleasure.
Sometimes you are here when I'm not here, and I always hate that. But thank you for coming here.
No, always a pleasure.
Good luck with High Rocks. So how far are you going to take High Rocks from here?
I don't know, actually. I think I might do the next one in November. Apparently, there's things in Joburg, so I think that's the next one.
Okay, and you're going to start with your shirt off this time?
I'm going to go half-half. I'm going to go half-half this time.
Crop top vibes.
Yeah, crop top vibes, yeah.
I think start with a crop top. Otherwise, yeah. I mean, your heart's got to be in it, Cooks.
Yeah, I think crop top's a great start.
Yeah, I think crop top.
Look, I think you're a big enough and likable enough guy that you can pull off a crop top. Because other guys will feel insecure, and they'll start just read the first couple of things.
Yeah. I think a crop top and then a headband.
Crop top and a headband.
Feel that.
All right, guys, that's it for today. 10 greatest photos. Like I said, we've done two episodes like this before, so troll back through our archives you'll learn so much through sport through our amazing photos. Flex in the booth, thanks as always, bringing up the heat on the images. Norm's in the background as well. Wonderful team as always. Catch you back next week with more of the On The Bounce Show.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm not easy.